Because who's Tanya?
What's your name?
David.
Oh, yes. Thank you, David. Hi, I'm Tanya, and I'm an addict.
Hi, Tanya.
God, help me. It's going to take me a while to settle into doing a chair because I haven't done a long chair and I haven't spoken into a speaker before. And my head feels very confused. I didn't prepare because I think it was good not to prepare. I thought I might just try and be in right relation with my higher power sitting here and talk about my experience and my strength and my hope. And yeah, to be in right, and I'm in right relation with my higher power sitting here looking at you guys. It's kind of moving me to tears, but this isn't the moment, because, you know, recovery and all you people who are in it, supporting me being in recovery, allows me to live. I am completely geared up, which is another word for powerless, I suppose, to take drugs. That I feel that's how I was made, from childhood, that I felt hysterical beyond human aid. I like that term because that's where I go. And when you're beyond human aid, drugs become quite useful. And that's my makeup. And without recovery, I can't really live with myself. And I couldn't live with myself on drugs either by the end of it, although I rather love drugs to begin with. In fact, I'm suffering from a lot of delusion, as usual, that I love drugs all the time. I was just talking to Sam because we came in the same time 9 years ago, and it's quite a long time ago. And then my 20s and my teens, where I took the most amount of drugs, is even longer ago. I mean, nobody here needs to be reminded of drugs, frankly. We all have this experience with them and the pain and the pleasure we got out of them. And but maybe because this is a very long chair, I am allowed to talk about my history a little bit, because I certainly couldn't talk about my higher power for half an hour. I'd like to be able to, but... where I'm at right now in terms of working the program is I'm working this program and another program in order to be able to do recovery and step work every single day. And if anyone thinks this is excessive, they're wrong, because every single day I have my head set right again. I become right-sized in my head by doing recovery and step work and reading things that I can't invent in my own makeup, reading ideas, you know, ideas about hope, ideas about the way I should relate to myself, the way I should relate to people outside. I don't have often very clever ideas about that, mostly because I'm so caught up in kind of a neurotic space, under pressure. I mean, right now, I mean, having said that, after 9 years of recovery, I feel I have a better relationship with myself. And so I don't want to entirely do myself down or anything, but I also don't want to lose sight, and that's what my new step work is all about. I don't want to lose sight of the fact that I am of unsound mind around an awful lot of issues. And I think where I've been in recovery about that before is that's a terrible thing. And I had to keep it very, very quiet, and I had developed lots of solitary strategies to get it all, you know, sorted out in my own head. Without a sponsor, or with an absent sponsor, or with a, you know, I mean, it's all been good. but there's been more working it out in my own head, and not even working it out, but living too long talking to myself in my own head. And what I've got now, because I have a daily check-in and daily work to do, I'm just not all alone with myself, with the things that I like to be very secret about, and that is a blessing. And I can tell you, it makes me a happier person. It's very easy for me to be unhappy, and so I need quite a bit of help not to be. And but I wouldn't have known that, you know, going back to my experience. And it was lovely, Mark, listening to your chair. Thank you very, very much. And it, going back to my experience of first taking drugs, sometimes I think I have to go back to when I was like a toddler. Maybe that's just my addict dramatic going on. But I was actually sort of force-fed drugs by my family. My mother was somebody who is... I can't claim she's an addict because she hasn't decided that for herself, but she couldn't look after her children, and she had to be on medication. She had mental health problems, and I feel terribly disloyal to my mother saying this, but to be honest with you, a lot of my pain and comes from a situation where I felt I was being suggested to do things that didn't feel right, and or things at a young age I didn't understand. Now, you know, it was lovely to hear Mark and all his humility just talk about feeling very, very different, and I suppose that's what it is. But it was also just feeling, well, these people who are trying to look after me just simply do not understand and do not want to help. And but they did want to help, and one of the ways they thought they could help me was by giving me this stuff called Phenagan, which was a fantastic drug to give me because it totally put me to sleep, you know, as a child, and I slept very, very badly, from whenever they needed me to go to sleep, in the car, you know, early on in the evening, whenever I was about, you know, hysterical about going out or worried about something. And I had reasons to be hysterical. My mother was on suicide watch, and so I had reasons to feel hysterical. And so perhaps Phenagan was very useful. But in case, I don't know if people know about Phenagan, it's actually off the market, but we used it when I was at university and we were coming off SMAC. We used Phenagan, and it would knock us out on coach journeys to Europe for the whole thing. So it was a strong potion, and I loved it as a child. So all I'm saying is that, you know, I'm geared up in all sorts of ways to be someone who thinks they need to take drugs. And thank God for this program, because I've now been 9 years without taking drugs, and I don't actually believe I'm necessarily... I don't have to be that person, I feel. By the grace of God each day, if I do enough step work, who has to take drugs. Anyway, the other thing I was sort of rabbiting on about was that I felt very bad about... myself and the way I was doing recovery. And I do feel that I come here, I feel very fraudulent being here, but that's part of my disease. To feel I'm can't do things well enough, and my strategies to avoid feelings around that have been to try very, very hard to be a perfectionist, to really try and succeed, and do all these things whilst neglecting really important human principles and things like, you know, and this recovery points me towards those things. And also, somebody rang me 2 days ago, things like compassion for myself. That's an incredibly difficult thing for me to access. Self-pity is easy, and I can really indulge in that to a point where it's absolutely no good for me. And I'm beginning to notice that now, this difference between indulging and having a feeling. And but I did experience something tricky this week, and if I wasn't working this program, it would be a great opportunity to go off on a real sorry drama story. I am so bored of my sorry drama stories in my emotional life that I'm working a program where I can boundary that. I do not have to go off and indulge on a really sorry story about my emotional life. And today I've got so much of a lovely life that is just sort of spoilt by that indulgence, that emotional indulgence. It's not that I'm entirely denying myself my emotions. I can feel they're there. I can feel them. I can feel there's confusion. There's a bit of grief in there. You know, I can feel that's going on, but it feels like it's just happening in a space inside me, and I'm not taking off on it. And I'm bloody relieved about that, because I've got quite bored of myself several times in recovery. This is another one, another time. And it's a long one. Going back again, because if anyone has any identification, I know that has always been a great thing in recovery, to get identification. But as a child, having an addict parent and being given drugs, and then being a child who wanted, and, you know, like Mark, at school, as soon as, you know, I heard about pills or anything one could take, poppers, I can't remember what they were called. There's something that we could get hold of at 11 or 12, some blue pills, and you just took as many as you could to see what the effect would be. And that was my personality, mate. You know, that was my personality profile. I was the child at the school who took as many pills as possible, or skipped lessons and hid in cupboards and crossed roads to get sweets. You know, when you weren't allowed to cross roads at junior school. That was my personality profile. I was the naughty one. And defiant as well, that defiant against authority. And I like, you know, the thing is, I like that profile, because it was a kind of big fuck you, and it was to a lot of things that I hadn't been happy about. And it was fun to take pills. I remember just going to my new secondary school. I used to love athletics. I was quite big on athletics and hurdles and high jump. And my friend's mother had 7 children and had been given these beta blockers and medication to deal with that. And I said, oh, bring some of those in so I can take lots of those, and then jump the high jump and do the hurdles. And it was just fantastic, because you could just sort of fling yourself at anything, and you could just get over any high bar. It was just sort of magic. And I remember the reverend at the school, who was kind of taking down, you know, the score of how high she jumped and how fast she went, was just sort of standing there. I was just like flinging myself around the pitch. So that was secret. That was, you know, good old secret drug taking, and getting false, sporting achievements at that age on it. And I had my comeuppance, because I got the hurdles. I got a hurdles. It was only 90 metres at that time, but I got a time that made me the fastest in Hammersmith. So I was sent to the London trials, and I didn't have my beta blockers at the London trials, and I could hardly get off the start, you know, before it was like over the third hurdle. And my mum was standing with our little dog at the side of the pitch. You know, I just felt like such an idiot. I put my hair in plaits, for God's sake, to hurdle. I mean, I don't know. It was more and more of the kinds of delusions I would get myself into, and drugs supported them. I was definitely not meant to be at the trials for hurdles. And so when I found out that one could do something called smoking dope, I just couldn't wait to get hold of it. You know, it was just like, that seemed to be my career, to try and get hold of the next, you know, the, hear about the drug and take it. And I was just not like my girlfriends, who were like circumspect, a bit anxious, what it might do to them. Just didn't occur to me to worry. It occurred to me to have a go at it, you know. And that is the unsound mind, I think, you know, I'm talking about the unsound, having unsound mind as a child around it. But I knew no other mind. That was the only mind I have experienced. So it's very difficult to know you're insane when it is the only head you've got on your shoulders. And you know, and I remember sort of thinking, oh yeah, let's try and go to parties, because then more of those people will be smoking that stuff and I can get hold of it. And I had an older brother, and so I could sort of trail along with him to parties where they were already smoking dope and taking other things. And, you know, I just would go to the party and sort of scout around for the person I'd taken drugs with the time before. And then that got boring, because I was too dependent on someone, so I needed to go and get it myself. And I've always been very good at going and getting drugs for myself. And I would find the money to get it, and I enjoyed finding the money to get it from my mother's handbag, or later on, you know, saving my pocket money and building up big stashes. And and making pathetic trips to Piccadilly Circus on the top bus with sunglasses on, you know, at 13, to try and, I mean, it was quite fun. You know, it was sort of meant to be fun, but the thing is, I was sold fake grass. And by the time it was found by my mother in the drawer, and I had been sort of shipped back home from Scotland, where I was taking lots of drugs with a friend up there, you know, I came home. I was about 14, and I was put on the train back to London, because they'd found this bag of grass. And I'm like, well, it's fucking fake. That seemed very unfair. And I was also a rather useless shopper of drugs, you know, going to White City, because I hadn't at that period of my life got the right kind of dealer. You know, I was good. I had a good deal. Almost always, sort of, if there was a good deal, I almost always fell in love with them too. So I had a kind of romantic fantasy about them. And but they didn't hang around long, those ones. I don't know where they disappeared to. Probably in here somewhere. So there were also awful desperate missions to housing estates, where I just hoped to find someone with a dog, with a fierce looking dog and some drugs. And I was often sold the wrong thing, but, you know, where someone of that sound mind wouldn't go back to threaten the person with the dog, I did, with, you know, another person of unsound mind, went charging back onto this fearsome estate in our posh accents, to threaten them if they didn't give us some proper gear. Jesus. And then when we didn't get enough, and then it was never enough, you know. And but the best thing was to find a boyfriend who took gear. That was the simplest in the end, because then you could just go and get it together and hang out together doing it at university, which is what I did. And that makes it all sound rather jolly, but it wasn't. A lot of vomiting and a lot of sort of distress. And, well, not active distress, because I couldn't really feel anything to be distressed about. And but other kinds of awkwardness of just actually not being able to face, you know, the other students who were clean and nice. And people I'd known at school who had gone on to the same university, who weren't taking drugs, crossing to the other side of the street and getting angry with me when I didn't really understand. I was sort of high on opium, I remember, and somebody who I'd got on really well with just refused to talk to me ever again because I was high on opium. And it just didn't, you know, I couldn't understand it. So lots of nuttiness. And I also have a my record is to sort of indulge in all those drugs and then to get myself off it, to go on a walkabout somewhere. A wilderness is great. Camping, you know, a solo trip to Scotland with a little single tent and a small bag of grass when you're trying to get off heroin as a, you know, 18-year-old is really was. It had to work. Yeah, where was I? I was having a flashback, obviously. Yeah, no, I mean, the thing is, being brought to my knees bit, because I didn't really understand I was already on my knees. Didn't really understand that I actually, frankly, was already on my knees, but when I really felt it and was guided towards this program was when I was in my mid-30s and I had a child, and I had stopped using. I'd in fact met the father of my child after I'd had an overdose, because I'd had a sort of crazy year deciding it would be okay to take smack after all, having had a two-year period where I realised it wasn't a good idea and drank a lot instead. I thought, actually, what the hell? I'm going to have a year where I do take it, and there was just never enough around, you know. And then I went off on a work trip to Australia and stopped off in Hong Kong. And my younger brother had a friend who was a pilot, and I knew he took drugs, so I immediately rang him and said, "Can I get some drugs?" Hard drugs. And you know, when you go and get hard drugs in Hong Kong, we're talking mounds, and that, you know, and I couldn't control myself over mounds, you know, you just go at it. And then I overdosed in a flat with my, you know, that I was staying in with my father, in the sense that I had to sort of hang on to everything, not to just sort of disintegrate onto the floor and swallow my own vomit. I frightened myself hugely. And when I got to Australia, I said to my kindly boss that I'd just sort of nearly killed myself, and I was rather concerned for my welfare. And he said, "Oh, well, he'd look after me." And then he pointed me towards a gentleman who he thought also might look after me. And I thought he was rather a nice looking gentleman, and I started going out with him. And the poor fellow, he didn't really know what he was getting into. And we had a love child. We conceived a child together, and this was only about sort of 8 weeks later after that time in Hong Kong. And we thought this was the best thing that happened to both of us, and we would, which it is, I have to point out, my daughter is the best thing that's ever happened to me. So we were right. And you know, being pregnant is just the most fantastic thing for me, though I've only done it once, but it was fantastic. It was very, and I was in the most wonderful pink cloud of romance and love, and it was very easy to put the heroin behind me and even just slow down on the pot. And so my pregnancy, and I think I've heard other women say this, you know, it is a really good substitute for drugs. And I mean, it is, to be honest with you, a way of really connecting with self, which is sort of another kind of way of having a right relation with your higher power, is to be in right relation with yourself. And when you have something growing inside you, it's a bit easier. And so just the history was that was all great until after she was born, and my love pink cloud fell away, and I became hysterical beyond human aid, and would throw myself at the bonnet of a car if I could, while the car was leaving the house with someone in it who I didn't want to leave, and also just the terror of not being able to look after my child, and so I went into an insane asylum with critical clinical depression, and stayed there for eight weeks and was put on lots of heavy medication. So just like my kind of infancy, tons of the Phenagan, you know, but this time Valiums and sleeping pills and this amazing drug called Manoril. Fucking hell, that completely conked me out. I mean, you know, the oblivion, there was no oblivion like that one. And it was a horrible, horrible one to come round from as well. And I shouldn't be indulging in stories about drugs, really. Sorry, that's my indulging side that I talk about. It's a defect. And but I was sick, and I was in an institution, and that's where this illness has taken me. And I was without my daughter, and, you know, and then I separated from her father because I couldn't stay with him. And I couldn't stop taking Valium, and then, but coming off the Valium, you know, when waking up from Valium, I would feel suicidal. And it's just a sort of sweet story about how I found NA, because I knew about NA, because I'd known loads of people went to NA, but it was never going to be for me. I also had this fantasy that I'd be able to take drugs until I was an old lady. And it was sort of, you know, it's the way I foresee myself. And so I didn't want to have to stop. And it's a sort of sweet tale. There was a parent at the school that my daughter was at who just, I never knew his name, but he became a kind of guiding light in some sort of crush sort of way. And but I still didn't know his name. But because I was so affected by him, I had to go into 12-step recovery to do with that kind of thing, relationship. And when I was in that kind of recovery, I realized I would have to own up that I was about to go and have a lovely heroin binge at a wedding party. And I had to own up afterwards that that's what I'd done. And it occurred to me that there were a couple of girls there who went to NA, and I could safely go to NA with one of them, because I knew about NA, but I really didn't feel I could safely go to NA until then. I slightly felt it might be full of all those dealers I had masses of, sort of, I was passionate about, and therefore it might be dangerous. So when I met these girls in this other program and came with them to NA, I went to a meeting, and the man who had been at the school, who I'd had the crush on, was the secretary of the meeting. And so I just think that was rather fantastic. And of course I thought that was because my higher power had done that, you know, for me. My male higher power. Not my female higher power, was doing other things. And I've never looked back, really. Well, I look back the whole time. I'm always thinking of what happened. And it's really hard for me to stay present. And I love stories. I love storytelling. And but it's sort of my recovery at the moment. It's more about discipline. So, you know, disciplining storytelling in a way, and just allowing myself to go back, you know, with a purpose, you know, just, okay, I'm going to write about that. But so I'm not in a just sort of a permanent slurry of kind of history, future, past and present. I do an awful lot of stuff to try and stay present. You know, tomorrow I'm going on a silent day retreat, and where I spend the whole day with these other people in silence. And I can get all my talking out here. We even eat in silence. You know, we trudge off from our little meditation pillows to a little restaurant, all eating in silence. We're only allowed to talk to the waiter once. And but it's fantastic. It's really fantastic. Because I'm sort of thinking I'm never going to be able to do it, and so I'm just pleased with myself that I'm being silent, and it helps. It helps. I mean, because right now I do get hysterical to points where I think, Jesus, what am I going to do? And those silent days come into my memory when I'm like that, and I'm reminded that I can actually be peaceful, and I can feel serene, and I can feel, you know, a sense of compassion for myself, which I get when being on silent days. And also one of the bit of step work that I'm doing right now, I had to define what breath was. I mean, you're going to wonder what program that is, but I had to define what breath is. I had to look it up in a dictionary. I can't remember what it was, but anyway, I think it was something like, it's like little pockets of air going in and out. And now when I'm hysterical, I just try and think of that. I just try and think of this little pocket of air. I'm just taking in this little pocket of air, and then I'm letting it out again. You're looking at me like I'm mad. Obviously not getting any identification on this one. I do get panicky. It's a panic attack, really, isn't it? I mean, put clinically. And I have to work out how to breathe again. And little pockets of air. That's all I've got. That's all life is. It's borrowing this little pocket of air, pulling it in and putting it out. And it doesn't need to get more complicated than that. If I can slow it down to just that, I'm quite often quite happy. So I have, and so I suppose you want to know what step I'm on or something like that. I managed to avoid that. We're coming to an end soon, aren't we? When's the 5? Okay. So I'm sort of slow on my steps. Some people say I do one a year. I do one every two years. Which is no good record. It's terrible, actually. But I've really got stuck on step 6. And this other program's really helping me with that, because I was just in a fog, frankly. And this is another thing, I don't know if anyone relates to this, but I find finding a sponsor, and I find sponsorship incredibly difficult, because I find it very hard to take suggestions. So I found another fellowship where you don't have the choice. And that's what I needed. No choice. Because it's no surprise, really, because I think the suggestions that were given me as a child were really... Well, I shouldn't say this, perhaps, but I still think they were rubbish. And I've done everything to try and rebel from that. It's just so hard not to continue in that vein. And so I have found it hard to take suggestions. And more than that, there's the complication of becoming emotionally dependent on someone, which is both, you know, something I'm completely terrified of, and is a symptom of my illness, that I will become emotionally dependent. I will think I absolutely need to talk to that person when I'm hysterical beyond human aid. And of course they're not going to be there. My sponsors haven't been able to be there. And that's just something I keep repeating for myself. And as if to say, you see, it was wrong, you know. Yeah, it was wrong in the past, and it's wrong now. And it's like, oh, please, I'm so bored of that. I'm bored of that. I want a different reality for myself. And, of course, this program is providing it slowly and, as they say, in God's time. And because otherwise I would have got it ages ago and I'd have been different. But I'm just really... really working on being in right relation with myself and this higher power. And the right relation I'm in with this sponsor I've got is that I ring them at the same time every day, and I talk to them only for a bounded time. Now that works for me, because if I was to ring a sponsor and I thought they had endless time to talk to me, I'd start worrying about whether I was boring them, whether I was taking up their time, and those are the thoughts that come ahead of being able to work my program or be intimate with this person, take suggestions from them, the thoughts that I get that muddle me are these kind of, I think they're codependent, I think that's what they call them, these thoughts of I'm taking up this person's time. And so I've got a sponsor in this program who lives in America, so I can't take up her time. I can send emails, and sometimes I think they went into her trash for a long time. I certainly didn't get a reply until I and that's sad, frankly. That's so stupid of me. But really, it's one of my major defects. It's called the solitary strategy, and it causes me enormous amounts of pain. So I'm very grateful for this program and this other one that provides me with this very defined time with a sponsor. And and also, you know, I mean, it's coming to these rooms that makes me feel I can live the life I lead, you know, which is fairly splendid, actually. I love my life. I don't really want to be too unhappy anymore because I've got so many nice things happening. It doesn't make sense. Why let myself get too unhappy now? I really want to work on staying much more balanced where I can. And when I can't, having some compassion for myself, because there are times I just can't be that balanced. And so thank you very, very much for listening to this chair.